Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm William Romano Pugh.
Hey, Willie. This is Jakob. Welcome back. This is the podcast where we do a deep read into each episode of The Wire.
Couldn't have said it better myself. If you want to give us any money, you can always do that at www.anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. And also give us 5 stars and good reviews on iTunes or whatever.
Yeah, thanks so much, Willie, and for making it known. Thanks to our current supporters,
We are here today to talk about season 3, episode 3 of The Wire, Dead Soldiers. And this starts out with Bunny and the real Jay Landsman, who is here playing Lieutenant Dennis Mello, going back into a Comstat meeting. And we can see the nerves are kind of catching up with Bunny because his day in the hot seat is getting closer. And he has an interesting little interaction with one of his commander colleagues in the bathroom where he overhears him throwing up while he's trying to like wash his face and get himself clean. Kind of more foreshadowing that Bunny doesn't really understand the implications of what he could be doing and how it could like potentially wreck him in the future. He's trying to console Marvin by saying like, oh, the best you could do is, or the worst they could do is bust you back to lieutenant, to which Marvin replies, I don't even want to think, or it's something like, I don't even want to think the worst of what these motherfuckers can do. So just really pretty effectively and succinctly laying it bare how nerve-wracking and crazy this whole Comstat situation is. Something that was originally meant to brought accountability to different police departments, but soon created like a culture of fear and terror and bullying that's first created in New York and kind of trickled on out to other police departments in the country. Baltimore, I think, was trying to model itself off of a New York style of policing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bunny, it's an important moment for Bunny. I don't know. One thing that stood out to me when he was, is that that's the scene where Marvin's also talking about, you know, the coroner's move. So
right.
It's a fluid situation. You can't just,
right,
you know, like the Reverend or Deacon said, you know, it's sweeping leaves on a windy day. And when Bunny realizes, you know, what's going on, and Marvin's talking about they're going to sell their drugs somewhere, you could definitely see the wheels start to turn and get us, you know, eventually to the one of the main themes of the season, which is the issue surrounding the war on drugs and how Bunny's going to approach that. I'm sure we'll get to that here soon, but
after this round of inquisition or, you know, psychological torture or humiliation that we see go down with Marvin and Burrell seconds the warning of the writing on the wall and whatnot, we do see Bunny kind of doing some field work with Lieutenant Mello and setting up the perimeter for what will, you know, we learn what we'll learn to know as Amsterdam. You know, we're still kind of in the dark exactly as to like what his plan is. But then that further prompts him to just kind of lay it out, lay the truth all out there in front of Rawls and Burrell and let them know that the felony rates are up and that crime isn't down in the Western District. And he's going to refuse to manipulate the facts or the statistics or whatnot because he's trying to prove a point, to which Rawls has a pretty brutal comeback where there's like an extended metaphor involving like a stripper waiting outside of the meeting room, and there's like a little 9-year-old girl in there who's like supposed to be, you know, interested in what Bunny has to say, but she's not even gonna like take his word for it because she doesn't want his job. Like, yeah, pretty brutal beatdown by Rawls there in that instance. But Bunny's holding strong to his convictions, even if he is getting reamed.
Well, this is also a big episode because of the statement surrounding this conversation on behalf of the police brass and talk of the gods and so forth. Real quick, before we get into, you know, all the reasons why we picked such a brilliant why the show, you know, is as brilliant as it is leading to our title. Obviously, you know, we're not brilliant for coming up with that as a name to our podcast. Just dialing back a second. Sorry for getting out of order here, because I know just as The Wire is a very linear show, we strive to produce a show that sort of mirrors that here. But Colvin and Mello, real landsmen out in the field, looking up for their locations. And I just found something that Simon said in the commentary, because this is another one of those episodes, so lots of great tidbits. But one of the sites was the old Armistead Gardens, which we talked a little bit about, which is kind of near, it's a project that's now abandoned, or I mean, at least that part of it is, but they've kind of done other things with the housing around there, like almost like cooperative stuff, which is sounds kind of cool. But it's near the favorite pit beef spot for Wee Bay and the Barksdales, and of course most Baltimoreans, I presume. But I just thought that was interesting. Of course, it's on the east side too, just like the other main spot for Hamsterdam, even though they're trying to place it on the west side by mentioning Stuart Hill Elementary at another site, which is kind of in the realm of the corner, like in West Baltimore. But yeah, I just found that interesting from David Simon. But getting back to the shellacking of Colvin, and, you know, why not just, yeah, we could talk about some of the bigger thematic elements here surrounding Burrell's statement, you know, about the gods and how they will not save you. You know, something we've said on this podcast as part of our introduction. I can't mess this part up. It's really important. But yeah, I mean, of course, when we were brainstorming names, it was definitely not on what might sound pretty cool. It was, of course, grounded in all of the major themes of the show, and talk of institution. And
there's a little back and forth between Colvin and Rawls and Burrell concerning what he could be doing better to keep the crime rate down. And he's kind of like being painted as uncooperative. But the hard, cold fact is that the way that everybody is policing right now, even if the statistics are getting lied about, isn't working for anybody, and that he just feels like he's kind of helpless in this moment and he wants a helping hand. To which Burrell replies, well, you know, if the gods are uncooperative, fuck them back. This is Baltimore. The gods will not save you, which kind of sums up a lot of what the show is about on the whole, really, because Simon has reiterated throughout the years that they took a lot of inspiration for this story from Greek tragedy, and how the Greek gods would come in and kind of just mess everything up, and characters don't really have like control of their fates. Everything is predetermined. Instead of the god doing that in this scenario, it's like these modern institutions that are just kind of like destining you to fail. So it's like Colvin, especially Bunny, has like a conscience as someone in law enforcement, and he's trying to make good on his promise for serving the community better right before he's about to retire. But we know that like these hard baked in ways of how policing is run in this country is just not going to let him take on the system.
I mean, yeah, and as you stated regarding the you know, broader themes of the shows with these postmodern institutions, how those on the lowest rung are you know, the ones who are often suffering the most, and how institutions that might be, you know, benevolent on their outset or intended to have that effect really become more oppressive as time moves forward. And, you know, it's like, it's a very cynical show, David Simon was stating, as far, you know, as not so much with the individual, but as far as portraying these institutions. And accountability is also a major theme in this episode, right, Willie? And how people are often trying to manipulate, you know, their way towards not actually having any in their capacities or personal lives or whatnot. But one character who might break out of that mold is Omar.
Yeah, we do see that he can hold himself more accountable for actions, but we also see kind of like the negative sides of his character, because he's so hell-bent on revenge at this point of continuously knocking down the Barksdale stash houses that, you know, he gets his crew involved in some rather nasty street gun battles, and unfortunately Tasha gets killed. But to get back to your original point, Omar does feel terrible about, you know, having someone in his little crew die, and he's, you know, burning cigarettes on the palm of his own hand and tearfully apologizing to his friends. So yeah, you're right, it does show that he can hold himself more accountable than maybe even like some of the top law enforcement officers. So
pretty crazy, because watching that scene does make one wonder, you know, how much goes into pulling something like that off. And Simon was talking about Lehane's ability to put it all together, but how he was a little bit resentful, you know, from the logistical side right. of things, because he's like, man, you're going to make us, just going to take a week to shoot. And they didn't even get to include everything, but
right.
Also putting a lot of stress on the neighborhood. Although yeah. this happened apparently up on Pimlico and Pall Mall, which I think is where, I mean, I'm yeah. pretty sure that's where Bunk mentioned, you know, sorry to let you know, really, I don't think those streets don't ever actually intersect. They run parallel up through up to like near Park Heights and stuff, where we'll maybe talk about where the details headed. But yeah, just the neighborhood, you know, it's kind of messed up when I think about it, because mm-hmm. the neighborhood thought that there was really, you know, a lot of shooting going down. Yeah. They had to keep on telling people that it's actually, you know, a film set, not an actual shootout, which it's like, yeah, you know,
pretty
for bad. Our entertainment, I guess. But yeah, also a first appearance and maybe foreshadowing for a character we're going to see right. a lot later on, a young guy,
Kennard.
Yeah.
Right.
And I meant to say this last episode, we saw Sherrod for the first time, which I didn't even realize until watching right. it, you know, this time around. But yeah, you know, definitely something of a kind of a revelation in the storyline of Omar, who Simon and, you know, mentioned is kind of this mythical figure, character in the show. Definitely an aberration, you know, as far as his levels of patience and ability to outlast just about anyone, surveil situations more in depth than actual police can.
Right.
But kind of a development that he talked about, George Pelicanos kind of coming up with, that, you know, there maybe would need to be some sort of challenge to that stereotype or that character trait of his, you know, kind of how revered he is, and in the fact that, you know, he actually might not be just as, you know, benevolent or good as he may seem. You know, there is damage that's being done to the community, and something that's really ticking Bunk off, or beginning to, you know.
Yeah.
As he thinks Tasha's an innocent bystander. So
right. And it's also interesting that when Bunk is at the scene investigating, he sees Kennard, who's shouting out, "It's my turn to be Omar. I'm Omar." And he's the one that ends up killing Omar. So
yeah,
also, yeah, we got to give a shout out to Dennis Lehane. This is his first episode on the series. And David Simon did point out how well he wrote that whole, you know, Omar robbing the stash house scene and the ensuing gun battle that happens from it. And it's just, you know, really incredible the way that unfolds. And I know that Richard Price was talking about, like, on another commentary about how he would feel like he'd be like a little bit of imposter syndrome, like writing for such a big show that, like, the city he doesn't know anything about. But the way that the drama and suspense unfolds in that scene just proves David Simon's point that they are like brilliant crime writers, and their talent would be welcome as long as they could just fill in the, you know, street names, because the language of suspense is universal.
Uh,
So since you were talking about Bunk on the scene there, you want to move it a little bit into his personal dilemma?
Sure, yeah. Bunk is, well, he's now caught a case that matters to him because of the nature of the shooting and what he believes, you know.
Right.
Tasha being, you know, a member of the community when in actuality she's really a dead soldier. Yeah, but I mean, he's also now stuck with locating Dozierman's service weapon, which someone named Peanut has. And apparently that's the most utilized street name in Baltimore. And you know, David Simon shed light on that in real life. And also we can see, I mean, there's obviously a lot of complexities, but he has a sheet with, you know, hundreds of peanuts to try to follow up with. But yeah, some pretty poignant or, you know, really powerful telling statements by Landsman, who kind of, you know, pushes back on Bunk's attempts to solve or look into the fresh double shooting. You know, he states it's in a zip code that doesn't matter. So that really stuck out to me. The results, and maybe playing into the whole police statistics thing, you know, with finding the gun in a city that's besieged by you know, weaponry is what takes precedent here. So that, got a lot going on.
Yeah. That little statement that Jay Landsman made was very indicative of like the whole police culture and the whole circumstance surrounding when they actually caught the guy who shot Dozierman. Jimmy sees him in the interrogation room and he's beaten up pretty badly from the cops. And he's kind of asking Bunk about like what happened, like, oh, did he give you that information before or after you beat the shit out of him? And Bunk kind of does this little chuckle and reads from a report that's supposedly like detailing the events of what happened in their little scuffle or interrogation. And it's always like interesting to me, like when cop shows or like cops in press conferences will use like a lot of flowery language or like, you know, police specific jargon to kind of like disguise the fact that they were involved in brutality. I mean, like Bunk almost looks kind of like pleased with like this little essay that he wrote that more or less like reveals that they, you know, took the law, like took things into their own hands, but tried to like dress it up linguistically to make it seem less bad. But it just, it seems like a really like funny, like, well, not funny because it's kind of like horrible that they can so often get away with shit like this. But
is that funny to you, Willie?
No, it's not. But it's just interesting that that's like a common theme that I've noticed in a lot of different police dramas.
Would this fall into the, is he juking the arrest report? Or, because
right?
we know how good they can be, or they can hide certain felonies. But Bunk does work in the department, which is, you know, responsible for the one stat that you can't actually, you know, hide or juke the bodies. But yeah, you know, McNulty doesn't really seem into it, right? And he's more into trying to prove that D'Angelo didn't kill himself. And maybe thinking about one of the rules that from Homicide, I remember, you know, it's like you could beat people, you know, if they don't move off the corners. But no, geez, I got to stop.
That's good. You're working on it.
You know, you don't beat a man to get a confession. You don't beat him while he's handcuffed, this and that. We've seen these rules broken many times now on this show. So I don't know what the commentary is or if there's any significance behind that, but you know, Bunk, he can write a decent report masking this police brutality.
This is a very emotional episode as well, because they're kind of trying to do their version of saying goodbye to Bob Colesbury, but still, you know, stay kind of like within the realm of the show. And they have a very emotional wake scene for him at a bar where Jay Landsman is making a speech, talking about how good of a police officer Ray Cole was, but it's kind of couched in references to Robert Colesbury's film career. He talks about him taking on a case in Mississippi, which is a reference to him working on the film Mississippi Burning. Mm-hmm. Something about an After Hours Club, which is a reference to when he worked on After Hours with Martin Scorsese. Great movie. They even mention The Corner because they talk about the drug wars on Fayette Street.
Yep.
But one thing that kind of like stood out to me, and you know, this is totally of my own reading and maybe reading too much into it, but he says something about like he took corners that were really hot and cooled them down. And I was like, is this like kind of in reference to like his role on the set of The Wire in general? Like whenever Dominic West was like, oh, I don't know, bro, if I miss my kids. And Robert Colesberry was kind of like, no, you just gotta, you know, trust the process and be a part of this. Like, was he that calming presence too that his character supposedly was on the more violent corners of Baltimore? We don't know.
As David Simon said, if he and the other, you know, directors and producers who are now tasked with this monumental, undertaking as far as the show is concerned, you know, if they were to get anything right, this had to be the scene. So they poured over the shots for hours. And I know Delaney Williams had said that it was taxing, but obviously well worth it. And he does a great job in delivering that. So we're all glad that he was signed with a stage production, because he would go back and forth to DC. And he was more of a stage actor, and then he had to get out of it, go to Baltimore to film this pretty monumental scene. So, you know, we're glad that happened. But it's a whole lot going on here. So what does this scene also speak to in regards to the theme of one of the themes of the show, the title of this episode, Dead Soldiers, is maybe a juxtaposition between Ray Cole's send-off and the camaraderie that's displayed even in it's a sad moment. You have detectives, cops, all different ethnicities and backgrounds coming together to sing, you know, his favorite send-off song by the Pogues. And then, you know, Tasha's empty wake, where the only people there are those who are trying to, kill anyone that, you know, could be a loved one, friend, and also are responsible more or less for her death. So different worlds, right?
Just want to comment real quick. Kima is becoming McNulty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Prez makes that assertion in the meeting they're having about their new target. And Kima's obviously really upset that they're not going after those who they set out to bust in the first place. So, yeah, she's taking a leak in the bushes. Her and Jimmy are bonding over their home life, or, you know, Kima's rapidly deteriorating situation, which McNulty's already been through, and seems to be a scourge of many detectives, that along with alcohol and boredom, of course. But with these two and this conversation, definitely it's not boring. I guess we could say that, but
definitely not. But I also do find it interesting that everybody is they're not trying to be subtle about it in this episode at all. Prez says it, and even Kima says at one point that she's becoming more like McNulty. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thinking about it in the scope of the show, we see that she's not willing to ID Weebe as the shooter when she first gets shot. And then at the end, when she finds out about their whole little ruse with like making up a serial killer, she rats them out and just kind of shows, you know, even though there might be some similarities, it's going to have to stop somewhere in her police work, and that she's her own person, and she's very much not like McNulty, has more of a code of honor.
What about the location? This commentary, it's very helpful because it kind of maybe dispels some of the nonsense that I talk about being a geo genius and this set on the railroad tracks has to be Calverton Road, and that's a spot in the book Homicide and blah blah blah. Simon, you know, heard it from the man himself. This is on the side of probably the first railroad tracks in the country, more or less, with the B&O Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which there's a museum not far from this, a little bit, I guess, east of where this is set. So kind of the theme of deindustrialization and this postmodern world where industry is, you know, obviously deteriorated. We saw a lot of that in season two, and they're sitting on this old railroad track with basically, I mean, I should know way more about this because I'm reading this ridiculous book about Baltimore and its political history, and basically the B&O Railroad, pretty much the foundation of a lot of the, I mean, as far as the industry is concerned, of course, but then a lot of the political turmoil that continued on to affect society as a greater whole because of the lack of balance as far as investing, you know, in resources for the community, as opposed to the amount of money and time spent on trying to develop this railroad. And it's extremely complicated. I can't explain all of it here, but huge institution, another institution maybe in the city of Baltimore. So just kind of the irony that, you know, industry now needs to be relegated to a museum when it should be, you know, doing what it does. Got to talk about the railroads here on The Gods Will Not Save You. What we got next here, Willie?
We finally, this is our first glimpse of Proposition Joe this season.
Oh, my man, Joe. What a guy, you know. He does string a solid, calls him to a meet to discuss the implications of the investigation about surrounding his nephew and his dog, which Stringer is a little confused by as well. But, you know, Prop Joe's always got some witty lines for us, so he warns Stringer about that.
And not to mention that he's, like, unbeknownst to himself, he's further delaying this whole catastrophe with McNulty poking around in his business by refusing to talk to Donette. Because she's trying to pass along the information to him that they're reinvestigating D'Angelo's suicide.
Yeah, exactly. He will not. He had time for her other days, but, you know.
Stringer showing his ass a little bit this episode.
Real quick, the whole tale about Peanut and Bunk finding the gun. Of course, like most things on the show, Simon states it's based on Harry Edgerton, Ed Burns' real life partner, who's involved in a lot of these cases, of course, that the show centers around, you know, major crimes unit and CID stuff. You know, he apparently had to go try to find some guy's gun or cop's gun, but I don't know if he ever found it, or Simon didn't really even know. I can't imagine how he keeps all the details, like fact, fiction. He does talk a lot about that, right, in this commentary? The blending of fact and fiction. Well, he was talking about that in relation to Carchetti, right, who's doing his councilman thing at a mixer of sorts. I'm going to talk about that stuff. Those Muldoons, man.
As we see Kima kind of getting her McNulty on earlier in this episode, we also see Carchetti pulling some Jimmy-like moves with weaseling his way around, like, the press and, like, getting the story out there about the academy class, getting some, like, narcissistic, playing some little narcissistic games that is meant to serve his greater political ambition, which he's like hasn't been completely forthright about with everybody up to this point. But it's becoming increasingly obvious that he has his eyes on more than just a city councilman seat.
Oh, yeah, he definitely does. He don't vote now. He makes Jimmy moves. That's Carchetti B.
Oh, nice.
So stupid. crazy stuff from Kirk Ketty. He's a real dog, you know?
Yeah. He is really kind of like, you know, coiling his way around the fringes of like, you know, political infighting and letting things go wild. And it's telling that one of the mayor's aides, like once they all realize that they're like kind of like gunning at each other's throats and there's real drama afoot. He says, like, come on, no one here wants to get a real job.
Yeah, exactly. Kind
of telling that they're willing to go to some pretty like manipulative lengths to hold on to their positions of power and try to find employment in another sector.
Hey, I got a real job, okay? I make real money. I mean, yeah. Again, back to the whole, one of the underlying themes here, accountability. Yeah. You know, they realize this is just another facet of the game that's being played. So,
Well, it's interesting that we see that Burrell, like, there's part of me that almost feels kind of sorry for him in a lot of these instances where he's made to take the heat for, you know, the Academy of class getting canceled or whatever. But there's like some weird like insecurity complex or toxic masculinity running rampant at the law enforcement because like he's taking all this shit and like having to bear the brunt of like a lot of nasty stuff. So then he turns around and really turns on the predator mode in the Comstat meetings and gives it to the majors like really rough. Like, do you think that's like sort of in response to like just him feeling like he needs to shit on somebody because he's getting shit on himself?
Yeah. From what I've seen, like, I agree with you there. I know that Faison, right? Frankie Faison. He said he thought, you know, Burrell's a nice guy and you just imagine him hanging out with his family because we don't really see the other side. We don't really get to know Burrell too in depth aside from his experiences City Hall or as a acting commissioner. But, oh, yeah, definitely, you know, frustrated with the way things are going, how he's being treated, and This new guy, Ketty, is kind of getting over on him in some regards, and you know he can only control so much, which is his ability to drop some really dope lines that then we mold into the name of our podcast. So, hey man, should we give some shout outs to Carcetti and Royce and everyone who and the Baltimore Sun, woo, getting Burrell all pissed off so he could drop some real gems. I don't know. It's all crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy that when Carcetti is cheating on his wife, it seems like he's almost excited by looking at himself in the mirror. It's pretty narcissistic, don't you think?
Carcetti's crazy. So what can he say? I mean, definitely. I thought when you were talking about he's starting to embody a little bit of McNulty, you're referring more to that too. Like,
definitely that.
Just. Yeah. Like that narcissism and just that, I don't know how drunk he is, but
even McNulty doesn't look at himself in the mirror when he's
he's too blind drunk to really look like anyway. He's just like, what, Scrapple? Huh? Blood? But Cuddy, man.
Cuddy from The Cut. We get some more scenes of his character kind of trying to readjust to normal life back in society. And he's trying to track down like an ex-girlfriend or ex-wife. And he sees her twin sister.
Yeah, her twin sister.
They're both played by the same person, Dravon James. Of the twin sisters, when Cuddy's trying to relocate his ex-girlfriend, who's now a teacher at a middle school.
And I really got some strong corner vibes. Like, it reminded me when they would all sit on the stoop or whatnot of one of, you know, the main house or row house. I don't know. It just was a great performance, but also it's like, she's the worst, man. She moved out to the county and she's a teacher. Not only that, she's a speech teacher. So she's helping kids that already are, you know, on the short end of things or at a bit of a disadvantage or possibly disabled in some regards. But, you know, what a terrible person helping out kids in the county. Maybe, you know, it's like, obviously there's larger implications, like the relationship with the city and the county and those, because newsflash, everyone just makes it seem like, oh, the white people left Baltimore, so that's why it's this and that. And without those people, they couldn't sustain. But plenty of middle-class black people and black people in general moved to the county as well for other opportunities. So, you know, maybe it's a whole different conversation, but, you know, it's more nuanced here. It's like, seems like a very personal beef between the sisters, but
yeah,
you know, by the way, Ida B. Wells, like, I'm like, which county is this in? Because I looked it up, of course, you know, like, oh, where, I wonder how close this actually is to the city. And the only Ida B. Wells middle school I could find is actually like on the outskirts of DC, which I'm sure they didn't go all the way to DC to shoot this scene. That's neither here nor there, of course. Well, it's there, it's like DC. Nah, Cuddy, yeah, I mean, Simon thought that maybe it would work out for him, right? He really is a fan of Chad Coleman in a suit. You know, the notions of, you know, Hollywood. I know we talk a lot about how this is the not, you know, it's a cop show, it's not a cop show. That, you know, it's, the importance is that it, in the ways that it does try to portray, you know, like more stereotypical scenes of a cop show, it always kind of flips that on its head as well. You know, this is where Cuddy should get the girl or the woman, you know, it should all work out happily ever after. It, you know, not by the end of the episode, but if it were a movie, by the end of the film. But instead, he gets told, if it hurts so bad, don't look at me. So he's being tested.
Yeah, you could tell that they both care for each other, but it's just not a realistic situation that she would end up back with him. You know, he went away to jail for 14 years. She's married and has a child now. Kind of working at dispelling the whole notion of redemption being like this grand, like transformative thing that comes overnight, when in reality it's like a painful, long process where you have to realize a lot of things are out of your grasp now that you can't ever get back.
Even though Cuddy's been away, and I know David Simon talked about this and how George Pelicanos is someone who writes extensively in his novels about, you know, those who have been released or are on their way back to redemption, even if it doesn't always work out for them. And how David Simon talking about, you know, in his experience, maybe people like Donnie or those who had extensive prison sentences and then came back to the city would remark on how much things have changed. And we talked about that, you know, at the beginning of this season already, how he's kind of like, wow, this is, look at, it's like nature's taking over in certain parts of, you know, where his neighborhood used to be, and more houses are boarded up and this and that. But Cuddy, still, he's really sharp with the NBA references, because he's like, oh, you name your kid after Allen Iverson? She's like, no, his dad. What are you talking about? So, you know, shouts out. Cuddy's been, you know, following along in the cut, I guess, you know. I mean, if Weebay has all those video games and whatnot, and I know they, you know, they have their day rooms, I'm sure, and he could follow the 76ers. You know, it's been a while since he talked ball, you know, talked some basketball. So I just, you know, it's been absent. We got the more the Cuddy's going to show some our way around the ring and throw us the ropes. But so
I get
nice grandma too. Meemaw's really nice.
Yeah, she has, you know, she says that she has to shine in his pocket, you know. That's nice.
Yeah.
Man, that's so painful in that moment, because he's like, you could tell he really needs the money.
Yeah.
But he wants to do the good grandson thing and kind of like be like, oh, no, I don't need this. He kind of tries to like overcompensate maybe. And he's like, you make sure you get something to eat now. Like,
yeah.
He's trying to be like,
yeah,
you know, the good grandson that's like going to take care of her. But like, she's really the one taking care of him. So he's like, well, what's the best I can do? Like, tell her to get something to eat. Like, I don't really have much to show right now, but I'm a good guy, I promise, Meemaw.
Yeah. we got Marlo. He is encouraging Fruit to do something about the coroners that are on Fremont Street taking business. So Fremont Street, one of those key arteries, you know, heading west out of downtown that Stringer and Avon are attempting to get a hold of for their own profit.
Right. And this is, again, kind of drawing parallels with earlier things we see in the episode. Marlo kind of like, you know, lecturing, you know, he's not as brutal as Rawls Arborell, but he's still kind of chastising Fruit in a public forum, kind of analogous to like the Comstat scenes where a subordinate is getting kind of chewed out by his superior in front of everybody and trying to be held accountable. So just kind of like reinforcing that idea that the chain of command is present no matter what milieu you're in.
It's kind of the way it all plays out. They weave it together rather brilliantly, as you know, obviously the show, it's all connected. And with McNulty and Kima are doing some recon and checking out the corners, and obviously they recognize Bodhi. Again, commentary very clutch here, because all my they're too close. Wouldn't they notice? Simon's like, unless you can film this through binoculars or whatever, it's not going to work with our lenses. So I get it. I need to do my homework. I know. I'm like, when he said that. I wonder how many minutes I've eaten up just blabbing about, oh, this isn't. Da-da-da. So, you know, filming is hard. I'm learning though. But you know, just as the cops are peeling off and Bodhi also leaves, really great timing there, saves him from a beatdown. They you know, Pudding and the rest of Barksdale's and Stringer's guys get whooped on pretty severely. I was just going to ask, you know, Marlo represents a new school. Is the whole bat thing, you know, I know I probably talked about that probably too much as well. You know, is that something that's just, you know, common as far as that moment in time, or because you would think like Marlo would definitely escalate it with guns right away and this and that, even though we do see how brutal he is and where this all leads to. Is starting off with the bats kind of just the next step from him threatening Bodhi with the golf club? Or, you know, it's bad, obviously. I can't imagine that, but, you know, they didn't shoot anyone and they still had the code as far as Fruit telling the youngest kid to stop and, you know. Right. It's time we've sent our message. So rather restrained.
I mean, I thought it was interesting that as they were beating them with bats, they had the guns drawn on them at the same time, almost as like a warning.
Yeah.
Like in a way, it's like almost more brutal because it's just like prolonging the physical and mental torture of like knowing that you're not wanted and that like we're going to try to like pounce on you to get you out of here.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd rather take a bat than like get shot. But I know, like, as far as the message is concerned, this if it ever became a police report, as they were exiting the row house stoop, they tragically slipped and fell down the stairs, the marble stairs that are very prominent in Baltimore and source of great pride in our city, and sustained numerous injuries. So no violence here. Yeah. So hey, it's a stat they could juke, right? Yeah. If it needed to come to that, but that's you know, not the point. But anyway,
they're, you know, say what you will about, you know, Marlo and his crew, but I don't think they're going to juke any stats. It's just interesting that he has like kind of like an old school and new school way of doing things, because, you know, when Stringer is like lecturing about like, oh, we gotta not be concerning ourselves with the territory, it's all about the product, you know, kind of trying to rid himself of the old like Avon way of thinking, and then all of a sudden Marlo shows up and he's like, oh no, it actually is about territory, and by the way, yours is gone now.
Ah, man, the irony. Well, it's all it's all come together, unfortunately, for everyone. Well, except the cops. Bubbles is coming back into the fray, so they got to watch out. And we learn a lot about the Western and Herc and Carver's inability to foster any trust or actual intelligence in their sector. And that, you know, they might as well be Marlo's crew with bats, right? unfortunately, but also really telling that just after that interaction with Kima and McNulty, they're brought into the meeting where essentially everything's laid out by Colvin that they are indeed going to push everyone, you know, to designated zones, because Colvin was in line when he said it's time to legalize the drugs. Great episode, man.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you've made it this far, we always appreciate you. If you want to reach out to us on any of the social media, Where the Gods Will Not Save You on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah. Also, shoot us an email. Same name there at gmail.com. The Gods Will Not Save You.
Yeah, that's great. And also, shout out to Mostart for doing the music. It's always really great to hear the intro and outro music and all the bumper stuff he's got going on. Really fantastic work there. Check him out on mostart.com. And as I've seen from some of the social media stuff, it looks like he has new work coming. So stay up.
Oh, yeah. The shout out to our guy Mostart Willie. And also thanks to our bud Andre. Awesome graphic designer. Hooked it up with the cut rate for our emblem. So, you know, tying it all together.
Yeah, thank you, Andre Tesnes.
Great stuff. Thank you.